welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast, where I'm going to ruin two last names in a row because I have two special guests. The film The Control is the one we're discussing this week. I have Michael Sasko and Eric Schiffler.
Schiller.
See, I told you I was going to screw them. Hey, guys, welcome to the show.
So, depending on the cursive, L's look like F's. I get it.
I can't pronounce. Michael knows me. I screw up everybody's name. So let's start, Michael. I wanted to start something with you. Your first project you gave me was a comedy, bunch of teens running around. Now you throw me out in the left field on a science fiction reality thing. How do you write two very different projects?
Yeah, and I think I alluded that to in the email that I gave you. These are like this is the spectrum of filmmaking, I guess. I couldn't think of two films more different than each other. But yeah, I mean, I was told in film, I did 10 years of film school, and I was told, like, as a director or a writer, you're supposed to, like, you know, you pick your theme or your genre and you get really good at that. And I really love comedies and I really like sci-fi films. So I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to go back and forth between the two. So that's what you're getting, I guess.
So, Eric, when you approach a project, do you approach every project the same way, or do you approach projects different depending if it's a comedy, murder mystery? How do you do it?
I think I approach them differently. There's sort of different things I look for in different genres of movie. So, for The Control, for example, like, it was really important for us to have a script that was like sort of really intricately structured and this, that. It's not as important in a comedy. In a comedy, I just want like good comedy beat delivered and everything like that. So, those two projects, of course, I didn't have anything to do with the writing of Boys versus Girls, but get approached totally different ways. Different things are important to me as I try and put myself in the audience's perspective. Like, different things are important for different movies. So kind of focus on the things that matter to the audience for that genre or type of film.
Now, in this film, did it matter which lead you played, or did you want to play a certain one?
I guess they're a little bit modeled after Mike and myself, personality wise. Neither of us are quite like the characters we play, but yeah, I don't think there was ever any question that Mike was going to play Mike and Eric was going to play Eric.
Okay. So Mike, is it easier to write for yourself then? Cause you know what you like to say, you know what your motivations are as a character. So it's easier to write for you and have somebody in mind, or you left this open for Eric? Did you know Eric was going to take the role at a time?
Yeah. Like, we wrote this at the very beginning, outlining it. We didn't have any illusions of grandeur. Like, we knew we were doing this as a do it yourself kind of film. Obviously, if at some point Leonardo DiCaprio said, I'm going to do the film, then we would have gladly bowed out for him kind of thing. But we knew this was otherwise a do-it-yourself thing. We knew that neither of us were top-notch actors. No offense, Eric, but I'm taking a hit there too.
Sure.
So we just kind of wrote it similar to ourselves. We really, what we wanted to showcase was our storytelling more than anything else, and how to write something that's very, very intricate and nuanced kind of thing. And we knew going in, we couldn't compete with the special effects of Hollywood or the good looking actors of Hollywood or the budget things. But we said, you know what, we can try to compete by doing something, a very different story that we haven't seen before. And that's what we're after.
So Eric, when you read your script and working on the script, how do you cope with the multiple realities? Or you're like, nope, script, I don't have to worry about that stuff. I'm just going to read my lines. Are you thinking while you're in different worlds, you're thinking a different way and approaching it a different way?
100% different. We had it really thoroughly mapped out beforehand. The sort of different levels of reality in the movie, we had color-coded. We knew exactly where we were at each point in the film. And without getting into any spoilers, like, depending on sort of which reality you're in the movie, the characters that you're seeing will have different motivations because, again, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a sort of top-down hierarchy where there's just sort of people in charge who are setting things up. their motivation is one thing, but the sort of characters within the realities have their own MO, and they're meant to be realistic within their own reality. So we actually, it was a bit of challenging because we wrote it, so it was in our heads, but to sort of explain this to some of the other actors who would ask, like, what's my motivation here? Okay, well, it's a little hard to distill in a couple of sentences, but, you know, we knew exactly where we were supposed to be at each point, and tried to be realistic about what our motivations and actions would be within each reality.
So, Michael, what is your motivation in each reality? No, I'm not going to ask you that question. When you're writing the script and you're looking for motivation in your script, obviously you have an idea, I want this to happen in this scene. But if you're writing a different motivation for each reality, how difficult is that for a writer to do that and have another actor in mind? I mean, obviously you know what your motivation is. You know what you wrote, but you got to also be that person. You're not Michael, you're your character.
Yeah, but to be frank, we did. It's not like I was playing someone that was crazy, more different than me. Obviously, it was someone with a different income and a different job and all that kind of stuff. But I wasn't also having to like walk with a limp or something like that, or have a different accent. So we kind of purposely gave ourselves an easier job as far as the characterization. So we were doing and saying things that we don't say, but I didn't have to like disguise my voice or anything like that. But it was also with this film, and I think I do this with all my films now, but this was one of them. Like, we spent a good 2-3 years just outlining it, just making sure the story was solid. So we're fine if, you know, if people watch it the first time or the second time, they're like, I don't get it, this makes no sense, you guys are crazy, that's fine. But we know, we're confident that if you do watch it and you do feel like you want to break it down, 100% of it makes sense, and there is an order. There's nothing in the film that's just weird for weird sake, or let's just throw this weird thing in here and see how the audience reacts. There is a code to be cracked there. So knowing that we had a solid structure that we spent 2-3 years outlining, you can then rely on the script, rely on the dialogue, rely on the beats, and know this scene serves a very much an exact purpose. And as long as I play with the scene, I've already looked at the big picture, and I know that it's the math equation will work out.
Yeah, I saw online some of the reviews for The Control, and one of them said, it's kind of a shambles, there's plot holes. In the back of my mind, I was like, no, there's not. There's no plot holes. We know that there aren't. Whether we conveyed everything as clear as we needed to is not, you know, we may have failed on that part. But as far as the logical structure of it, it's we feel like it's taught.
Well, let me come to this as a guy who just saw this once. I do think it needs a second viewing because now I understand the plot. I understood how you got to the end. Now, I will say at times, was I confused? Absolutely, I was, but I know that was my fault because I'm taking notes at the same time as I'm watching. So I'm like, okay, I've missed something here, and that's my fault. So I've gone back a bit, and I'm like, on second watch and not taking notes, I think I would definitely be able to piece this together a lot easier for me. My main problem is I'm taking notes at the same time I'm watching. I'm like, oh, what's going on here? What's going on there? Let me make a note of that. That's a good question to ask. So should you tell viewers, this is a good to watch. You really need to watch this twice and pay attention. Put the phone away. Stop Snapchatting. Watch the film because you're going to miss something.
That's very fair. You know, and I think that we might have sort of made a misstep here, but we kind of expected, we wanted people to watch it twice.
Okay, perfect.
It's particularly the first act, when you have no sense, like if you don't know the trailer or the synopsis or whatever, and you just watch the first act, it's pretty much impossible for you to, you know, forecast the ending. We kind of wanted an ending that would make people think, oh, I need to go back and watch that again, which is, you know, probably a triumph and a failing of this movie, because you're not really supposed to make movies that people can't get the first time around. I think in my Hollywood 101 book, I read that somewhere, but decided, you know, we get to make what we want, and let's try and make it interesting and not as easy, a little more challenging than your average movie. So, yeah, I do think there's a legitimate gripe to be had there that it is not not the kind of thing that you can probably watch once and feel like, oh, I'm perfectly satisfied with my experience of that, and then walk away.
So, Michael, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'd say in one of the biggest learning moments that I have as a filmmaker now is when we finally take it to film festivals and you're sitting with the live audience for the first time and they're reacting to it and you can feel the reaction in the room. And it's still the first 20, 30 minutes of the film is really hard to watch and it's uncomfortable because if you're looking at it as a normal structure, it's very uncomfortable. There's not a lot of hand holding. There's no fence post to know where you're at kind of thing. There's a lot of what would seem to be false starts. So I don't blame people for having a weird reaction that first thing. And to kind of echo what Eric said earlier, yeah, from a writing point of view, we feel like it's taught and everything's there. But that doesn't mean as like directors, we fully executed it as best as we could. I'm sure in other hands, someone could have done even a better job than us as far as the directing end and conveying the information. But yeah, the one thing I want people to know is that there's no randomness in there. If you take a look at it second or third time, if you're that generous to give us that much of your time, all the elements are in there to connect it.
Oh, I really felt you guys were looking for a TV show plywood out of this. Cause I agree with you. The first 20 minutes, I was like, I don't really know where you're going, but then I started piecing it together and I'm like, this should be a TV show. This is totally good for a TV show because when the realities start to open and I start to understand a lot more, I'm like, this should be a TV show. I can see this being up week one, kind of confusing. Week two explains a bit more. And then the jumping, you got at least 22 episodes here to get to that end. And you could add some villains. I can see creatures. I was thinking, is this a big TV pilot that didn't go anywhere? And you said, screw it, we're going to make a film out of it, is what I thought originally.
If anyone listening thinks idea, like, let's know. I never thought of it that way, actually, but what you're saying makes a lot of sense because there is a lot there that you could unpack into a larger format for sure.
Yeah. We'll bring you on as a staff writer. Perfect.
Oh, well, thank you. I can't write well. I could do your interviews, your media for you, no problem, but not really a good writer, but I could help. Well, go ahead.
No, I was just saying it was part of what Eric and I initially discussed because we had made other features beforehand and other shorts. And every time you make an independent film, I feel anyway, there's a little bit of you're almost creating a lottery ticket, whether it's going to be seen by an audience or seen by people. And you could go, and we both have enough of the skill set, I think, that you could make an effective feature. Like if you look at Boys versus Girls, it's got a plot and a story and it follows, you know, the three act structure kind of thing. And you can display to people as a filmmaker, yes, I know how to execute the normal thing that everyone wants to watch to make it accessible. But I think Eric and I both went about this project as like, let's play the lottery with it. And let's say, let's do a story that's we haven't seen anywhere, something that we'd be attracted to, but that is so different that no matter what, they can't write it up and say, oh, it's just exactly like this film or it's exactly like this film. At the very least, they have to say, oh yeah, they did something completely different here and try something different.
Well, okay. Before I do want to get more into the film, but I have one last question. How do you split up your directing? Do one of you direct a scene, the other one direct a scene? Or if you're in the scene, the other one's directing? I'm just trying to figure that out because both of you are co-directors, both of you are co-writers. So you both know the project really well.
Yeah, a lot of it came down to who had the heavier acting duty in each particular scene. And we basically divided it up pretty much 50-50. when Mike was going to be the primary character in the scene, then I would direct that part of it. I mean, all of the directorial decisions were discussed by both of us beforehand. But on the day, yeah, we sort of just traded off scene by scene. You know, you direct this scene, yeah. I'm in front of the camera, and vice versa.
Yeah, neither one of us were like surprising the other person with the decisions that we were making on the day. Like we both were well aware of exactly what shots need to be given on any given day. There was even one day, I think it was like our third last day, one of the rare days I wasn't in a seat, and I was sick. I was barfing at home all day, and that day I was supposed to direct the whole day because Eric was in it a bunch and other actors, And it was to the point, though, but that I felt comfortable enough that I was from the laying on the floor in the bathroom on a cell phone talking to Eric, going over the direction. But when I looked at the dailies of what he got that day, it was what was in my head and what we discussed. So I had full confidence that he could pull it off and get the shots. Cause again, we weren't making stuff up on the day or just like feeling it. It was like planned out what shots we wanted.
Yeah. Everything was pretty much storyboarded. If not thoroughly storyboarded, it was at least like we had a pretty thorough understanding of what we each wanted from each scene. So yeah, going back and forth. And even if I was directing a scene and Mike had an idea of how we could alter the shot to make it a little better, there was no like ego about that. He would just say, "Why don't you try this? Oh, good idea." So we kind of worked well as a team like that. I don't know that it was always a mystery to me how people could co-direct a movie, because to be a movie sort of has to be one person's vision, but it was really, it was a breeze, you know. Considering it was the first sort of feature I've ever had a hand in directing, it was like, yeah, okay, this is pretty good. It helps to have a partner in crime.
So there's one location I really want to discuss. You have a cabin kind of thing overlooking a lake. That is beautiful. Yes. I couldn't let that. Mike knows I love discussing locations. This one does have a lot. But that one definitely kept me fascinated. Like the look, and I don't know which one of you two picked the shot selections. Excellent choices. Even in the cabin, I liked outside the cabin shooting. So where are we?
That was, let me think about that. There was a guy working on our project,
Kurt Sasso.
Yeah. And he lived there, or his parents lived there or something like that. He's a young guy. Maybe they both lived there, and it was a beautiful spot. And, I think we had a completely different location in mind when we went to do the location scouting, but, it kind of met all the sort of hard criteria. And then it had this added bonus of having just a boat sitting on the grass, like a giant boat just sitting there for no reason other than like, it looked cool. So that was like, well, okay, why not take use of that? It was kind of neat.
So was it a cold day by the water? It's nice and warm. It looks warm in the photo.
It's a good question. I don't even remember, to be honest.
We shot, because we did shoot this film, and we did 3 weeks in, I think, July 2015. And then it was two weekends that fall over like October. And then there was a whole other week the following winter in February, because we had to, if you watch the film, there's a few things where we jump in.
Season.
So I think, and then we did a pickup day. So it ended up being like 26 shooting days, but it was spread over about a year of shooting. So I think when we shot that though, it was summertime.
I think it was pretty nice. And part of the reason I think I would remember if it's cold, because when we shot a previous film of Mike's, Iodine, there was like a couple of scenes where people had to be in the wild, in the woods in like Northern Ontario. And we shot it in like April or something like that. And like super hypothermic conditions. That was probably not as safe as it then. That I remember very well. So I expect the boat scene was pretty breezy outside. No problem.
Where did you steal Winnebago from, Mike?
Pardon?
You have a gigantic Winnebago. I wrote down it could have been a film cruise truck. I thought it maybe was the actual film cruise truck.
I'll let Erica take that one.
Yeah, it was actually a friend of my mother's had this thing, and he basically just volunteered to let us use it. And we did use it as like a traveling location in a couple of spots. And on those days, yes, it definitely doubled as a gear truck, because we weren't the type of production that had like massive U-Haul trucks to just cart around gear. So everything was like going to people's trunks and on people's laps and so forth. So yeah, it did definitely double as like a staging area / camera closet for the camera people when they needed to have their alone time between takes and so forth. But yeah, it was a total gift. We just, someone offered it and we said, yeah, we could definitely use this. We had been looking for one having a hard time finding it. And then this one just sort of fell into our lap. So it actually worked out great.
Okay. I'm going to jump to the end of the film. There won't be a spoiler question here. I want to know, did you guys change your lenses at the very last shots of the film? I want to say the location, but I won't. That was just maybe you guys don't remember. It looked like definitely a lens change to me, or maybe you changed the lighting on me a lot.
Are you talking about in the laboratory?
Yes.
I don't think there were any specific lens changes, although the lens kit that we were using had, I don't think it was like your standard like Zeiss, you know, 8 to 65 prime kit or something like that. It was kind of a mishmash of what, you know, different lenses and so forth. So I don't remember making any conscious decision that we need to change our lenses, but we sort of shot the very ending of it slightly differently. So maybe that just necessitated a different lens or something like that. But it wasn't quite a while ago. So a detail like that, if we did make a decision consciously, it slipped my mind completely.
Hey, you have a look of helmets. Whose idea was to work on the helmet? It had to look very science fiction, obviously, and look futuristic at times.
Yeah, that helmet, which is called the God Helmet, is actually based on a real life thing that exists up in Sudbury. And at one point, I think I can say this now, we had contacted like the guy who actually ran the experiment of the God Helmet, and we had him originally agreed to be in the film to play himself and to actually use his location and his God helmet. And then I think before I was like, I sent him another email, like, hey, we're heading up to film the scene. And he's like, wait, I thought this was like a documentary you were doing. We're like, no, it's like a fiction thing, a science fiction thing, and you're in it. And he's like, yeah, I don't know about that. So then we had to, production designer Jessica Cook worked with our art director, Greg Maxwell. And I think the helmet was Greg Maxwell, though, that designed it, but I think he did look at pictures of the real deal and kind of stole a little bit out of it, but made it his own. But yeah, that is a real thing where they have a helmet that has different electromagnetic pulses on it, whether it works with electricity and magnets. And by moving these magnets and electricity around, there's been studies, I guess, where they can make this effect as if you're seeing God or experiencing God. So it's kind of like meant as like an atheist tool to disprove God or whatever. But then some people say, well, maybe it's a proof of God or whatever. But yeah, it was pulled from real life. But it was just us trying to, I think initially when we were the roots of us starting to write the script, I believe, Eric, was how many different types of reality exist, right? Because, you know, there's like waking life and there's dreams, but then there's like drugs, there's like virtual reality. And then we wrote down like all these different levels that could possibly exist. And we came up with like, there's more than you'd think. There was like 12 or 15 of them. And the God helmet being one of them. What if you had magnets affecting your brain thinking you were observing God? That would be a different level of reality. So even before we came up with the whole concept, it was kind of, we wanted to do something about people experiencing different levels of reality and playing with that as a milieu kind of thing. So I think the God helmet stuff was in there before we even plotted the film.
Yeah, I think it was one of the initial things that got us really fired up about this. And I remember being pretty disappointed that we couldn't actually go up and use the real deal, because the whole idea was we would go up there and film this guy as himself doing the actual experiment. And as a bonus, one of us would get to try it out. But that never ended up happening.
That must have been disappointing. That sounds like something I would enjoy. See, send the intern out. I can go do that for you.
Yeah, well, I would have hogged it myself if I could have, but it wasn't meant to be. But it is a very cool idea and worth like looking up some of the testimonials and stuff. There's probably YouTube videos of it. Yeah. If you look up the God helmet. It's an interesting thing. I still would like to try it. Although, I think that some of the studies have been, at least questioned by years and so forth, but interesting nonetheless.
Now, do you guys feel you set the stage of the film with the chess? You play chess twice early on in the film. Is that supposed to set me up for the whole mind-warping reality? Because chess, to me, is a very mind game.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that in there. We sort of thought of the conflict between Mike and Eric as like a chess game, in that there's sort of subtle moves and big moves. That sometimes you can't tell when a move at one point might pop up and make the difference, you know, an hour into the game or something like that. So just as an allegory and as a symbol, we thought it kind of made good sense. And we're both fans of chess. but yeah, we did sort of describe it in one of the synopses, I think, that we had to write for one of the press things as a sort of chess game between realities. So, yeah, if there was anything more profound to it than that, I don't really remember. But also just a good advertisement for chess. Go play chess.
Yeah, I think it was one of the last things we tacked on to the final draft of the script, was that opening chess scene, because that the opening of the films are so important, right, to kind of just set up a thesis statement for what the film is. And I think we had, as much as like there's like 20 cold openings in the first 20 minutes, we kind of wanted to put a little something there to hint to the audience, because the people who play the chess game aren't even like main characters or whatever. But at least to set people up. Yeah. To set people up, like what you're watching is people playing a game, you know?
Yeah.
So if you want to subconsciously start to decode the film, you at least are getting the visual from the filmmaker saying, you are watching people play a game.
And right. That, and it's a little cerebral, and don't expect any explosions.
Yeah.
How is working with CGI in the film? Like, do you guys like doing CGI? I mean, you have to have it here. Don't get me wrong. But I mean, other films you don't. Do you find it difficult to work with that? Or you're like, nope, that's just what we're going to do. We'll get somebody to do it in post.
Well, it was a necessity in this. And just up front, neither Mike or I did any of the CGI ourselves. We found friends and other professionals to take it on. But once we actually started to write it out, we kind of ran into some spots where we were like, yeah, we need some kind of effect here, something that is logically or physically impossible in the scene. And we kind of fell back on this very convenient motif that, like, what we're seeing is, if this scene takes place within a computer program, then there can be odd, like, digital glitches and strange sort of video artifacts and stuff like that. So it kind of gave us a little more latitude on, I guess, what we felt like we could get away with in terms of special effects. Like, they didn't have to look like, we didn't have to go and do any super elaborate, in-camera effects. Like, they can be digital effects because they would be digital effects within the reality of this movie. So I think that actually, once we realized that, it became pretty fun because, you know, there's a scene where, one of the characters is standing on the street and Mike drives away from him. And then it sort of breaks up in a very odd way that looks like a video problem, almost like digital video was corrupted. And we thought that was pretty cool. Like, we can kind of get away with these. It doesn't look like an organic effect. It looks like a digital effect. So once we realized that was something we could kind of fall back on within the logic of the movie, we were like up for it. We were really and pretty pleased with some of the effects that we ended up getting. It was kind of fun to work on. I don't think it was at the forefront of our mind, though, really, the effects. It was kind of done by necessity because we just kind of needed certain effects to put people in that headspace. Maybe Mike can add to that. I'm not sure if I elaborated.
Yeah, it was, really. Neither of us had done a lot of work with effects in a lot of our other films beforehand, almost like close to none. So we weren't really effects heavy filmmakers. But the thing that was a little uncomfortable about the film was, like, we were making some strong decisions on what actually made sense. So, for example, without giving too much away, I probably am giving stuff away, but the program in the reality is a program in a reality that's, like, barely holding itself together and was cobbled up from a bunch of other existing things, right? So if you had a program like that that was faltering, the effects of that being messed up wouldn't look like beautiful Star Trek kind of gorgeous, like, holodeck stuff. It would look like crappy 1980s video game effects of things messing up. So when you watch the film and you see some of the effects, and they're like Eric described, like these crunchy digital video toaster effects, we chose that on purpose. But then it's also because it makes absolute logic to us. But then when you watch it, the audience is like, why are they doing like weird effects there? Because it doesn't, why you could have done better ones for the same amount of money or whatever, but it made sense for the, what we were doing for the film or whatever. So it's always, it's neat watching it because you make decisions, but then you see other filmmakers. This is an odd reference, but like, when you watch like Terminator 2, which is an amazing movie and I love it, but there's this logic point that I've talked to Eric about before, where if you're the Terminator and you're a computer, then you wouldn't be displaying stuff on your eyeball to tell you the information back to you, right? Because you're a computer. A computer doesn't display information, read the information that they just displayed, and then now it becomes part of their data set. They already know that information. So right. When you see the Terminator walking around and all this like John Connor thing pops up, that makes no sense. The reason it's in there is because it's a function for the audience to see what the computer's thinking and all that kind of stuff. So the whole display, the point of view of the Terminator is solely there for the audience. Otherwise, he can just talk to himself internally, right? So, but it's an amazing movie and that works as a great narrative device because the audience needs to follow along with the Terminator. Whereas we made a decision in our film where, like, these effects of, like, the world breaking up in a shitty computer program would look crappy and crumbly and all this and not be smooth. So that's what we're going to do in our film. But then you watch it and you're like, why are they doing that? So kind of mixed on that.
Okay. When you guys are writing a movie, does pacing ever come about with you guys at all? Or do you just let it flow and worry about pacing later?
The initial outlines, we weren't concerned. But as Mike mentioned, this went through a lot of outlining, a lot of different iterations. I think even after we got the scripting, we did something like, 17 drafts or something like that. So the deeper we got, the more we paid attention to the pacing. Particularly like as we got into pre-production and we started to get our locations together and this and that, it started to crystallize in our head, I think, what this is going to look like. And then I think we did a lot of last minute, like rejigging of the script to try and like keep that front end a little tighter and snappier, because we kind of knew going in that the first act was going to be a little more challenging, to get to the meat of the story for people. That's my impression of it. Maybe Mike has a different view of how the pacing played in, though.
Yeah, I mean, the structure of the story, we did actually use a bit of a cheat code and kind of laid it along the Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. We kind of knew what beats we wanted to hit along and knew that would be kind of an attractive story. The thing that I found in editing, and still when I watch it with an audience, is if you're not following along or you tune out at a certain point, then all of a sudden certain scenes that should be stressful or should be big or whatever, if you're not with the logic of it, then all of a sudden that scene isn't an important thing, or it's just weird, or why is that there kind of thing. So it's very easy to lose the audience in this film. And then as a result, they don't enjoy the pacing. But from what I've heard from a small few who really dig the film, is upon that second viewing, and they know all the answers and now they're seeing all the stuff there, then all of a sudden everything becomes more saturated and like, oh my God, they can see the depth. So all of a sudden the pacing seems a lot better on that second viewing, which I don't know if is a good thing or whatever, but that's what we did.
So 17 drafts. I don't mean to be rude. Does it normally take 17 drafts to write a film, or is that just what you guys felt this one needed?
I work as a professor too, and I tell my students, like, and I agree with this, story is the absolutely most important thing for any film at any level, at any budget, any actors, any director. If you don't have a story that's going to engage the audience, or at least engage the target audience that it's supposed to, there's a good argument that our film, The Control, is only meant to engage about 10% of the audience out there. And it's okay that it's not for everyone. We're fine with that. But that 10% that we're after, we really want to engage them. We really want to hit them hard with it. So I don't think you can spend enough time on story, and you can really rework it and rewrite it. Because there's a lot of other things you can't change, and there's a lot of other things you can't compete with. But story should be one that, at any level, you should be able to compete with everyone else at.
Also, just a peculiarity of how we wrote this was that originally we didn't have really a production in mind. We were just writing it to write it. And so we had no deadline. So we were just taking our time, and we were, you know, throwing stuff at the wall and seeing how it stuck. And so we just kind of were very casual about, like, we were diligent and worked early, but we weren't stressfully working toward any kind of production deadline. So we gave ourselves the ability to just, like outline for 2 years and then do draft after draft. And then once we found out that we could go into pre-production, then we had to put the pedal to the metal and then do a whole bunch more drafts because, you know, the closer you get, the more problems you find. As the sort of practical nature of the production comes to rear its head, it's like, well, okay, this is going to be really tough to shoot. Can we sub it out for something else? What does that mean for these other scenes and so forth? So, yeah, 17 drafts sounds like a lot, but probably a lot of those drafts were very similar to each other. It's just one scene got, you know, plucked out, and this scene got moved to over here and so forth. But yeah, it was, I agree with Mike. Like, you can't, you know, it is the most important thing. And if you have, and most writers are just writing, you know, especially independent writers, they're not writing to deliver by a deadline. So just, you better write the hell out of it and make sure you do your best before the stress is on.
I gotta ask that last question. As an independent writer, you guys have a lot of ideas. I mean, you don't make multi-millions, I get that. But don't you guys want it out of your system to get to the next project? Or you're just not in that hurry because you're like, I'm independent, I'll get it done when I get it done. I guess that's what I'm thinking. Like, you want it out. Like, as a podcaster, my argument is I want to get the interview done so I can get to the next interview. So that's what I'm thinking about a film. Like, you guys want to get out there. You want to be making money. You want to show people, this is what I can do. And if your process is taking 17 drafts in 2 years to get it made, is that just too hard at times?
I think, and I'll answer for Eric too, but he can correct me if I'm wrong. We could have made a decision 20 years ago when we started filmmaking to say, let's move to LA and do any work you possibly can. And the idea is 90 to 95% of the work you do, you're doing for a paycheck. So you're writing TV shows and doing infomercials and working as a grip on a bad movie kind of thing. So that every 5 or 10 years, you can finally do that one beautiful thing that you're proud of and that you want to do. But I think we both kind of made the decision where it's, let's just skip doing that other 95%, and we can have other jobs to make money to pay our mortgage. But now we just get to make the things that we really want to do. So we're not really doing, I mean, early on in the first 5, 10 years, we were doing other stuff because we just wanted to work and film. But at least now I'm at the point that I'm not doing a project ever, or a show or a TV show where it's like, well, I need this for the paycheck and I want to get this done so I can get on the next thing. It's just like, whatever the thing that's in front of me is, I'm going to work that until it's ready to go. because this is the one special item that I have to do. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. Also, as a writer, as an independent writer without like, it's not like beholden to a company or studio or anything like that. For me, yeah, I have like no shortage of ideas. So, I will have, you know, 4 to 5 sort of projects in my head or outline or whatever in different stages of progress. So when I'm like scripting one thing, you know, I'll be outlining another. So, when we were initially outlining the control, we were not living in the same city. And so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't prime time, I think, for either of us initially. We were both writing other stuff and working on other stuff. And it was just, we just started picking at it as like, okay, well, we wanted to write a sci-fi movie together, like something that we would want to watch, something that was, you know, sort of bizarre enough that if I went to an independent film festival and saw it, I'd be like, hey, I never saw anything like that before. So we, where we were living and how the project came about, we just kind of by circumstance had this sort of casual start to it where we could like sort of spend, I think we met like once or twice a week over the course of 2 years or something.
This is what I mentioned to you in Boys versus Girls, how I was driving from, I was teaching at Ryerson and at Western and at the University of Ottawa, and I was doing this loop, and that's why I stopped at Ajax so much to get gas. But while I was doing that loop, I would meet up with Eric like twice a week on the way to, the way from. And sometimes we met at his place, and sometimes we met at like sketchy outlet malls, like cafeterias we would do writing, like depending on like the time of the day or where we were doing stuff. But yeah, for a couple of years, we met like twice a week at random places.
Okay, you guys are finally here. Michael's been here before. Eric, this is your first time. It's fun question time.
Okay.
So you have to answer the first one. Michael's already answered, so he's safe. But I'll find him something else to answer next time I see him. What is your favorite film?
It's probably 2001: A Space Odyssey. But there are a lot of other movies that while I'm watching them or for a couple of days after I'm watching them, I'm like, no, that's my favorite movie. Lost Highway is another one that is often a strong contender for favorite film. And any of the Twin Peaks universe, particularly The Fire Walk with Me, is always very near the top.
I'm seeing a trend in those three films.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bit of and probably The Control makes sense to you within that context. Like
it does.
I like a movie that when I walk out of a movie, I don't want to just have it be done and be like, okay, I watched that, the end. I want to be able to think about it and like wonder about it, you know, for as long as possible. And if it can sustain my interest over years and several rewatchings, then that to me is ideal. Like I want to still have questions about it after, you know, mastering the content of it. That's what appeals to me in movies.
Don't worry. The next two are really easy tonight. Your favorite beverage, both of you?
I drink like coffee and beer. So those top two. And
oh, no, I'm not letting you go in the beer thing. What kind of beer and what country?
Well, this is a whole can of worms because I'm like one of these beer nerd guys. Like I'm on Untappd and all that. So I drink everything. Pretty much like barley wine and, you know, Belgian like lambic beers. Those are my sort of two like special beers that I get.
So you're drinking the barley wine. You're like me. You're looking for like an 8 and above. That is really your choice.
Not so much for a weeknight, but weekend rolls around, I want something that can, if I drink too fast, knock me down.
Oh, I'm with you. We could drink any time together because I just drank a barley line last week. That's 11. That's a nice drink.
Yeah.
Michael?
That's great.
Well, I'm a big fan of dark black coffee like Eric. But if you're going for specificity, Dad's root beer is my guilty pleasure.
Which is probably the best root beer I've ever had in my life.
It is. It is. It tastes different because people – I know beers obviously have a whole different palate and there is a great thing. But for me, a root beer has a different palate.
Like I would argue there's hundreds of different root beers because my uncle's a root beer connoisseur and I'm not lying to you. I've had every kind of – I can't believe there's stores that just sell root beer.
Yeah.
And I've tried numerous – and the different taste in root beer blew me away trying different root beers.
It's, and the aftertaste is very different too with root beers. But Dad's root beer is, which is popular enough, but it seems to beat out almost everything I've had. So
I'm with you.
I haven't done it. I'd like to do a side by side of Dad's and A&W because to me, A&W is like the mass market gold standard. But it's been a long time since I had one of your dads when I was there.
A&W is like a cream beer. It's like having a. It's like drinking a Hogarth.
Very, very creamy.
Right?
Tons of vanilla.
And then a Dad's is perfect. Like a Dad's would be drinking like a Blanche de Chambly.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with a Hogarden, but that Blanche just has that taste you want.
Yeah. I will go out and buy some Dad's actually just because of this conversation.
There you go. We got them going. Now your favorite dessert, because we're all at home eating, so help me out.
Oh. That's a tough one. Favorite dessert. I do like, and it's cliche as could be, but I do really like a warm slice of cherry pie with a cup of coffee after dinner. That's up there. I used to do a ton of like cheesecake. Mike and I used to play poker at a casino just outside of the GTA and they would sell in the restaurant, they would sell these slices of cheesecake for something like 49 cents or something. If you had like your player's card or something outrageous. So we would eat like 3-4 slices of cheesecake every time we were there to play poker. So I've eaten like more than my share.
I think we were aware of it, but we were the exact target audience they were after, were the lost leader, right? Like come get 99 cent cheesecake. And by the way, you spend $200 in the casino while you're here.
Yeah, it's like I lost $400, but think of how much money I saved on cheesecake.
I'll have to go with my favorite like dessert in that respect would be Rice Krispie treats. You can find them everywhere, but I'll also put up there what you can't find as much is like the real mint chocolate gelato. Eric and I were lucky enough to go to Nice, France for one of the European premiere of The Control. And whenever you're in a European country, they have gelato all over the place. And I'll have two of those a day and indulge when you can. But not so much in North America. There's not – or it's not the same thing anyway.
Right.
Now, since we haven't really discussed the film and people are probably very interested in what we've watched, why don't we tell them where we can find it? And if it's a good time to promote websites and stuff like that.
Yeah, The Control right now in North America is available on just about anywhere you would want to find a movie except Netflix. It's on iTunes, movies? Google Play, Prime.
It's on Amazon. If you have Amazon Prime, it's free right now, so you can watch it. That's probably the easiest way to get a hold of it.
Yeah, you can even watch it through like your PlayStation, through their sort of network and so forth. And there are a lot of outlets. So I think if anyone looks for it, they will find it. But they should know that there's another movie called Control, which is not our movie.
Type in The Control, people. That's the easiest way to find it. It's 2018.
If I have to Google it for some reason because I need to find a website or something, I always Google Control Stasko because his name is not so popular that I'm going to run into a problem. Websites, we don't have an official website, I think. We do have a Facebook site if you look for the Control movie. Is it the Control movie?
We have Twitter too, I think.
We do have Twitter, and we are on Instagram, although Yes, we are on all three of those platforms. I think, ostensibly in charge of them, but they're very inactive. There's not a lot going on right now. I'm horrible at social media, and we don't have a dedicated PR person. So I sort of answer people's questions and post things like this when the links become available.
Well, that's nice to hear. Thank you both for your time and have a great evening.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.